And welcome to the morning session of the Second Court of Appeals, and welcome here to you all. We have five or six cases, I think one's dropped off, set for submission this morning, but only two will be orally argued, one at 9 and the next one is not until 10:30, so we'll take a break after the oral argument in this case. And if the lawyers are ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case and introduce the lawyers.
The court will now call Black Bull Tony and Al versus T. Barr. You may please the court, Mr. Thomas Carl to argue for the appellant, and Mr. Warren Nard to argue for the appellant.
Okay, Mr. Coward, are you ready to proceed? Okay, come forward and tell us about this case.
Good morning, Your Honors. Tom Cowart for the appellants. Black Bull Towing and Whispering Woods Apartment Complex, along with co-counsel Victor Hume and Seth Lightfoot. Your Honors, this is a case that arises out of the towing statute, the Towing and Booting Act. It's got some other claims that were pled in the underlying petition, but what we're here on is a judgment that grants relief only under the towing statute. The towing statute is a pretty thorough administrative statute that's found in the occupation code that governs the non-consent tows that are made of vehicles that are left in places where they ought not be left. It covers tows from public places and also covers tows from private places. This case here arises out of two tows, in fact, from a parking lot complex. Black Bull Towing is the tow truck operator, the business that operates the tow truck. Whispering Woods, the other appellant defendant in the case, is the apartment complex. The first issue that we've brought up in our brief that I'm going to address initially is the question of the trial court's jurisdiction to award the relief that it awarded here. When you look at the judgment, let me fall back a little bit on that. When you look at the judgment in the case, it arises out of a kind of convoluted summary judgment proceeding. The plaintiff filed a motion for summary judgment seeking relief on a variety of claims that they had pled, including the Towing Act claims, a theft liability act claim, a declaratory judgment act claim, a conversion claim. The trial court initially granted relief on the summary judgment motion on the Theft Act, the Towing Act, and the Declaratory Judgment Act. Those are the primary grounds for the monetary relief granted. So the initial judgment involved both actual damages, statutory damages under both the Towing Act and the Theft Liability Act, and attorney's fees. On a motion for new trial, the trial court backed off of the Theft Act relief and backed off of the attorney's fees relief, which was granted under, I think, both the Theft Act and the declaratory judgment. So all that came out, and all that was left was the Towing Act relief in the summary judgment order. Then on another motion to reconsider and to modify, the trial court put the Lehman versus Harkon finality language into the judgment. So what the trial court did was it granted relief on the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment for affirmative relief. It granted relief under the Towing Act, and then it, in effect, and intended to, and so it did dismiss all the other claims in the case, even though there was no basis for doing so. So we've got a final judgment here, because that's what the trial court intended, and under Lehman, that's what the requirement is. If the trial court intends for it to be final, whether it should have been final or shouldn't have been final, it is. So we've got a final judgment here. The only relief the only basis for the actual relief that's granted is the Towing Act, the Towing and Booting Act. And the problem we've got with that is that the Towing and Booting Act, and it's, if you're looking at the briefs in a PDF format, it's the statute is included in my brief as an appendix, and it's PDF page 43, or it is, if you look at the Westlaw paging on it, it's Westlaw page 12 in my appendix, where section 2308.453 is set out. And what that section says, a hearing under this chapter shall be in any justice court. So our position, Your Honors, is that when the legislature comes in and says a hearing under this chapter, and the chapter is 2308, so it includes all the claims that are being asserted or all the basis for all the relief granted in the summary judgment motion and in the judgment that followed that's before you today. All that has to be brought initially in a JP court. This court, the court that granted this is not a case that came up on appeal from a JP court, a justice court. This is a case that originated in county court at law. So when the county court at law attempts to render a first judgment, if you will, on a claim under the Towing and Booting Act, it's our position that the legislature has said that court doesn't have jurisdiction. That court does not have initial jurisdiction to consider the Towing and Booting Act claims that were brought by the plaintiff here as a matter of first impression. The statute says that after you've had a claim brought in the justice court, the appeals from that claim go as in any other JP court appeal would go. So that would go to the county court at law. But the court that has original jurisdiction and where the case should first be brought when you're seeking relief under this chapter, according to 453, is the justice court. Now, plaintiff has come back along and said, well, if you look at the statute, there's some other places where claims might be brought, or the amount of damages that could be sought in a justice court is limited, so that doesn't make any sense. Well, it doesn't matter what makes sense to a certain extent, right? Because we're bound by what the legislature has done. The court's supposed to take statutes as they find them. The court's not supposed to rewrite statutes to correct what it perceives to be errors. That's what the legislative function is. So the court, our position is the court ought to just take this statute and say when the legislature said any hearing under this chapter, it meant exactly what it says. Any hearing under this chapter has to start off in JP court.
And strange language that it would say hearing and not suit must be filed or words to that effect.
And I agree with you that it's a little odd, Judge. The plaintiff has come back and said, well, the statute uses hearing in other places, and so when it refers to that hearing here in 2308-453, it must be confining itself to the kind of hearing that it describes in other portions of the statute. But if that's the case, you have to choose in between which of these two words you're going to give effect to. You have to say, I'm either going to say that a hearing is only limited to what the legislature described in other places of the statute, or the chapter means what it says and it applies to all claims under this chapter. I think, you know, from my perspective, Judge, hearing is a more general word. I agree it's an odd word, but it's a more general word than chapter. And it makes more sense to say a hearing is what courts do. That's what you have in courts. You take complaints to a court and it has a hearing on the complaint. A court hears complaints. And so that's a word that's more generally applicable than chapter. Chapter is a term of art in a statute. It means a certain body or a certain subsection, subpart of that statute as a whole. So when it refers to a chapter, I think that's that word has more force than the hearing word does. But also, Your Honor, if you back off a little bit and look at the statute as a whole, it makes sense as well. Primarily because this statute gives and it also takes away if you enforce 453's restriction on jurisdiction to the JP court. The complaint in my mind that has the most force, it's coming from the plaintiff, or the counterargument that has the most force, it comes from the plaintiff, is, well, that doesn't make any sense. What if I've got really massive damages? And they throw out this example of a BMW that gets rained upon. The thing is, though, the statute here relieves the plaintiff of the burden of proof of showing negligence. It simply says, yeah, the one I didn't write down and where I could point you exactly where it is in my that's on the page before. It's on PDF page 42 or page 11. It's section 404, 2308.404, subpart B. A vehicle's owner or operator is not required to prove negligence of a parking facility owner, towing company, or booting company to recover under subsection A. So the legislature has given the complaining party, the vehicle owner, a real benefit in this statute. It says basically if you've got them on a technical violation of the statute, you can get your damages. You do not have to show any kind of negligence on their part. You do not have to show any kind of culpability, essentially. It's a strict liability statute. So in exchange for relieving them of the burden of proof on a negligence claim and saying simply if you can show they violated the statute, you can get some of these damages, the legislators come back in and said, but if you're going to take advantage of that part of the statute, you're confined to a JP court with its limited remedies. They didn't intend, I don't think, for somebody to be able to come in, as in the plaintiff's example, and say, you ruined my $100,000 car and not have to show some culpability on the part of the defendant. They didn't intend for it to be a strict liability, unlimited strict liability type of a claim, in my opinion. They intended for it to be, we give you something here, on the one hand, we're going to give you the benefit of the statute, which is a technical violation of the statute without showing of a mental state, essentially, or some sort of culpability will get you damages. But in exchange for that, you're limited in the kind of damages you can get. The plaintiff complains that if you accept that argument, there'd be no remedy for the BMW driver who gets their car ruined because it was left out in the rain and after it was towed. But that's not right. I mean, if you take somebody's car and you leave it out in the rain, you are guilty of negligence. You are guilty of violating essentially an implied bailment type of an arrangement. Those are separate causes of action. If you want to bring that claim, you can bring that separate claim in a county court or in a district court because you're not proceeding under this statute. But if you're proceeding under this statute and you're trying to take advantage of the technical aspects of the statute and trying to take advantage of the lower burden of proof in this statute, then you've accepted the benefit offered by the legislature, and in exchange for that, you've got to accept the burden offered by the legislature or imposed by the legislature, which is JP court. You can step outside of that burden, right? You can step outside of that limitation provider established by the legislature by bringing a common law claim. This statute doesn't say that all common law claims are eradicated. If your very expensive car is ruined as a result of something stupid that the tow truck driver did or something stupid that the storage facility did, you have a common law claim in my view. So the argument that there's no remedy for the expensive BMW or other vehicle isn't correct, I don't believe, because the common law survives on those kind of claims. And even if it is correct, which I'm not accepting that it is, but even if it is correct, that's for the legislature to decide. This statute says all hearings brought under this chapter, and under this chapter means any of these claims for a technical violation, all hearings under this chapter has to be in JP court. The statute says all hearings has to be in JP court. And I think that you are confined to that language in determining whether the lower court had jurisdiction to render the judgment awarding damages to this plaintiff for the technical violations of the towing act that he's complaining about. Now, what are the technical violations that we're talking about here? That's the second thing that the summary judgment motion addresses, or the judgment addresses. The Towing and Booting Act sets out very specific requirements on the property owners and on the tow truck operators in terms of what has to be done before you can do a non-consent tow. If you think about it, and you know, common law probably, if absent these kind of claims, if you just pull up and tow somebody's vehicle, you've probably committed some sort of conversion or theft, trespass to chattel or theft or conversion of the car. The legislature has come in and said, no, you can do that. And there's certain instances where if you follow the rules that we've set out here, you're allowed to just hook up to somebody's car and scound with it. You got to give it back to them when they pay the fees. And this court, in an unpublished opinion, said there's a difference in between messing up on your technical requirements under the statute and stealing somebody's car. But you can't say, I'm protected from a theft prosecution because I was acting pursuant to the statute in all instances. But the kind of complaints that the plaintiff has brought here have to do with the size of the lettering on the sign. The statute says, I think it has to be 2 inches, and they allege that our sign was only 1 inch. The statute says that the sign that has the required language has to be a certain distance off the ground, and they say that our sign was too low. The statute says that the parking lot owner has to give the tow truck driver written verification that the appropriate signs have been placed up on the parking lot, and they say that verification wasn't in the record. The statute says that you can't start towing unless you have standing authority by the parking lot owner to do so. And those are really the violations. So they're really all just technical violations of the statute. None of them go to any kind of common law duty that a tow truck driver would have before starting to tow people's truck. So going back to the jurisdictional argument again just for a second, notice those are all technical violations. They only come out of this statute. And the claims coming out of the statute, it's not a rain damage case. It's a technical violation case. So any claims that are technical violations coming out of the statute, we argue have to be brought in the first instance in JP court. But then looking at their summary judgment motion on these claims, we set it out in our brief pretty thoroughly. None of these things are proved by their summary judgment evidence as a matter of law. The only one that they come close to is the question about whether the sign was 1 inch or 2 inches required by the statute. But all they showed there was that it was 1 inch. And the statute says that a minor variation is not a violation. It's section 2308.407, which is PDF page 43. Again, it's the top of that Westlaw page 12 in my appendix. So in a summary judgment context, and we did raise this in the trial court and in our response to the summary judgment motion in clerk's record 73. So that light's red. I didn't even realize I was running out of time, Your Honor. Thank you for your time.
You finish your statement, please.
We did raise it, the minor variation issue, because the statute says it's not a violation. The burden's on them to prove that it's not a minor violation, I believe, in general, and most particularly in a summary judgment. And just showing size doesn't show comparison, to my mind, and that's almost always going to be a fact issue because it's a scale issue.
Okay, so under the plaintiff's pleadings, which were brought in county court instead of justice court, if the county court had no county court of law had no jurisdiction, then we have no jurisdiction to hear the appeal, right?
Yes, ma'am. It's kind of a tricky deal in that regard because he also brought some non-theft or non-statute towing act statute claims. So our position is that he didn't have jurisdiction to render the relief granted, not that he didn't have jurisdiction over the entire case, because he had some theft act. The plaintiff pled theft act, trespass to chattel, declaratory judgment, all things that were clearly within the county court at law's initial jurisdiction, but not the claim that it rendered relief on. So this has to be vacated and sent back, and that claim would be dismissed for want of jurisdiction, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, now we'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court. My name is Warren Norrid. I'm here with Chad Lampe.
Counsel.
Supported Pete Ybarra. And as the court has seen and as it's been argued, this case has two issues. The first one is jurisdiction, and the second one is the evidence for the MSJ. We have provided a handout, and this is part of the record starting at the clerk's record at page 129, which is a very succinct, very well done opinion by Judge Rabel that disposes of this argument over jurisdiction. Judge Rabel, faced with this in a couple of cases back, was looked at this exact question. In 1995, Chapter 685 of the Transportation Code was renumbered by Senate Bill 971. I was going to print that off. It was about 2,000 pages. And what it did was just renumber the Transportation Code and set apart this the discussion on the verbiage on the Texas Towing and Booting Act. And it has a line in it, and on page 2 of Judge Rabel's opinion, it has a quote, which was legislative intent of no substantive change. Prior to 1995, the question of jurisdiction for the Texas towing tow hearing was in a chapter. That verbiage was not changed, but simply brought over into the new law. Prior to 1995, county courts at law could hear these towing, or the justices of the peace, I'm sorry, could hear the tow hearings. And after 1995, they could continue. This bill that created this language, which now is a little bit confusing, was not intended to change anything. And no court in Texas that I know of has ruled the way that this court is being asked to rule today. I would recommend this reading. It's 4 or 5 pages. It's very well put together. I couldn't add to it, and so I just gave it to you for your to get so that you can look at it. But the transportation code initially had the word chapter, and it was just simply brought over. As the court pointed out a few minutes ago, it uses the word hearing. It's referring to a tow hearing. Looking at the broader picture of the Texas Towing and Booting Act, there is one subchapter that talks about tow hearings. There's another chapter entirely that talks about different methods of regulating under the Texas Towing and Booting Act. And that section talks about criminal acts, class C misdemeanors, TDLR, enforcing the act, and these, what we call Section 404 civil suits. And these civil suits are kind of like QTAM operations. This Texas State Legislature has said, we want private individuals to have a private right of action to enforce the act. And so these are two very distinct kinds of suits. The tow hearing is a simple act, simple hearing before the JP, where lawyers are encouraged not to be involved. That's supposed to be a simple, fast, 2 or 3 week process. The civil suit is very different. It's the 404 action that you see before us. I've also provided for you in the record, starting at page 134, your sister court in the Fifth District in Dallas looked at a similar question last year when a litigant brought its tow hearing, successfully won its tow hearing, filed a civil suit based on 404 in the county court, and the defendant in that case argued, you should have asked for everything that you were going to get. You only get one shot. And we successfully argued before Dallas that these are two distinct operations. One is a simple economic protection measure, the tow hearing, and one is a civil suit. They're very different. It would be wrong to say that the Fifth District answers this question completely, but it would be fair to say that inherent in its opinion is clearly they've looked at the jurisdiction issue, and they talk about how county courts and district courts can hear these. It is assumed by them, certainly, in their discussion that it should be able to be heard in a county court. To the second issue, I would ask the court, I've also provided Exhibit B from Ybarra's MSJ, which was his affidavit. This is the only, this and its attachments are the only evidence. I'm turning now to the MSJ sufficiency of the evidence argument.
Is that another handout or is that in your appendix?
I gave it to you.
Okay.
And I didn't give you the attachments, but I did give you the affidavit with the statements. And this is the evidence we have. We don't have any evidence that the sign was 5 feet up off the ground. We have only this verbiage. We have only Mr. Ybarra's verbiage that says the entire message was 2 inches in height. We have only the evidence that Mr. Ybarra said that the sign was less than 5 feet from the ground. The bottom edge of the sign was approximately 20 inches from the ground. We don't have any evidence. There's no contravening evidence. There's no scintilla of material evidence that's different that the other side has put forward. It's easy to lose that in opposing counsel's argument, but there simply is nothing. There's no argument here. Of course, every tow company in the land would love for this court to come out and say that 1 inch is a minor variation of 2 inches. Now, I understand that as a past engineer, I would say that 50% is a pretty substantial difference. And some people, if we were talking about the 5 foot off the ground and it was actually 4 foot 10, that's not what the statute's talking about. It's talking about the lettering. But I suspect that we might lose that case because that is, in fact, a minor variation depending on how the soil conditions of the day. We don't have anything like that. We have a statement that's uncontroverted. The lettering is 1 inch. And we have a statement that's uncontroverted that says that the bottom of the sign was 20 inches off the ground. 20 inches is nowhere near 5 feet. Nowhere near. And so opposing counsel wants to say, well, there are two signs together and that the bottom of the top sign was 5 feet off. Well, that's not in evidence. We would object to that discussion. All we have is 20 inches and 1 inch. So the trial court looked at that and said that 1 inch is not a minor variation of 2 inches. Now, of course, what is before the court is not whether or not 1.9 inches. We don't know that. We don't know what a minor variation is. That's not being asked. We're not asking the court to define that today. All we're asking the court to say is that 1 inch is clearly not a minor variation of 2 inches. Maybe someday we'll have a case where somebody's got 1.9 inches and we have to decide that. But that's not the case today. I'm prepared to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Mm-hmm. I don't believe we have any questions, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Cowart, do we have a rebuttal? Do you have rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honors. I think counsel's correct that no court has ruled on this issue in Texas as far as the jurisdictional question goes. The Dallas Court of Appeals opinion that he references kind of falls out the way he said it does, but the question is not presented there. Did the lower court have jurisdiction under the statute? The question is a res judicata. And the what the court looks at is that provision out of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code that says a decision in a lower court is not binding on the higher court, a JP decision. And it also points out that in the JP court in that case, the lower court's decision only involved the car owner and the tow truck company, whereas the case that's in front of the Dallas Court of Appeals is the car owner versus the homeowners association, essentially the property owner that caused the tow. So yes, that court does say that the county court at law's proceeding is not barred by res judicata, but it doesn't address the question that's presented squarely here of the jurisdictional issue, whether the county court at law had jurisdiction in the first instance to consider the case. On the summary judgment evidence, what's referred to is the affidavit by Mr. Guevara, and on page 54 of the clerk's record, specifically talking about the distance from the ground to the bottom of the sign, he says that bottom was less than 5 feet from ground level, as can be seen in the attached photograph. Those photographs are clerk's record 66, 64, and 66. And those photographs clearly show that he's measuring the bottom of the sign, as we say in our brief, from an attached sign, not the tow wax sign. And I know that sounds confusing, but the tow wax says a sign has to have certain verbiage on it. That sign's at the very top of the post when you look at this picture. There are two other signs underneath that picture that aren't required by the tow act. And so those signs are attached to the same post, but they're not part of the top sign. There's clearly a distinction. So to say there's no evidence to controvert this claim that the bottom of the sign was less than 20 inches from the ground isn't correct. The photograph itself that's referenced in the affidavit controverts that statement. It proves the point that I'm trying to make in the brief. Same thing with the disparity in the sign lettering size, 1 inch or 2 inch. But more fundamentally on the sign lettering size, you know, the claim that they don't know what a minor variation is kind of proves the point. This is a summary judgment proceeding. It's a summary judgment proceeding. You're not permitted to come into court and say, I don't know what it actually is, but I win on summary judgment anyway. Because the point of a summary judgment is there are no fact issues left for a fact finder to determine. There's nothing to present to the finder of fact. Our position is that almost as a matter of law, when you start talking about whether variations are minor or not, that's a fact issue. You can't come in and say, well, 1.9 is maybe a fact issue, but 1 is not a fact issue. Everywhere along that scale, the question is that a minor variation according to the fact finder or not, in our view? That's in our thinking is that if you come into court and all you show is the disparity in the size, you've pled right into that statutory provision that says a minor variation is not a violation of the statute, and that becomes a fact issue for some fact finder, a jury or a judge.
There's not a factual dispute that the portion of the sign that was contended to be too short was 1 inch as opposed to 2 inch.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So then the question is merely, is that 1 inch variation the statutory standard of being minor in its relationship to the 2 inches.
Yes, sir.
1 inch related to 2 inches, that minor.
Yes, sir. That's really where it comes down to. And if that's a fact issue, then a summary judgment can't be granted.
But your contention is that is a fact issue and not a matter of law.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Precisely with the argument. There's other issues that we're relying on for our brief. The two issues I've been able to argue today are not the only issues, and relying on our brief for the rest of those arguments.
How do you address what your opposing counsel has called a very fine letter by Judge Ravel?
It's a letter written by a county court at law judge who provides a legal analysis that, should the court find is appropriate and persuasive, is the law.
The subchapter versus chapter discussion.
Yes, sir.
Of course, there is no question that the consolidation of statutes was intended whenever they were doing the code recodification, that there was not intended to make any substantive change in the law. Is a change when you put two statutes together and they're both using the word chapter and they come from different parts of what was the old law, is that a place where there is to be application of a interpretive decision made as to what's the intent of the legislature?
Your Honor, I think that when you're dealing with issues of that kind of magnitude, where you're talking about the use of the word chapter there, that controls. And I understand what you're saying, that, oh, you know, maybe they didn't mean for that word chapter to actually mean the entire statute that you're dealing with. But they've had the opportunity to go back and revisit that statute. They've had the opportunity to come back and say, oh, we're going to change that word to mean subchapter, and they haven't. They've used chapter continuously.
I'm just really asking you, not so much the what your analysis that you just gave me. I missed you with my question, and I apologize. What I mean to ask is, do you dispute that the guiding principle for us to follow as appellate court is what was the intention of the legislature in codifying these two separate chapters?
I do not, Judge, but you're guided by the plain language of the statute primarily.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Your case is submitted, and we appreciate your arguments and your briefing. Very interesting issue of first impression. You are excused, and we will take a recess for until 10:30.
All right. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas is now in.